Kim Gandy, before we talk about October being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, a couple quick questions about what's happening in Washington. How did the shutdown of the federal government affect programs that serve victims of domestic violence?
It had a dramatic impact on some programs, particularly programs that had already been hit hard by the sequester and by federal, state, and local budget cuts and were sort of on the edge living, payroll to payroll. The federal shutdown affected them very desperately because they couldn't pull down the funds that they were due under the various government programs that fund their operations. The way those programs work is the program itself basically pays for its expenses for 2 weeks and then draws down 2 weeks' worth of expenses or a month's worth of expenses from its grant. And so when they went in the end of September to draw down their September money so that they could operate in October, there was nobody there to release the money to them.
What about the ongoing effect of the sequestration on services for victims of domestic violence?
That's had a very, very real and measurable impact. There's the sequester has impacted the Family Violence Prevention and Services funding, which is the core funding for the shelters. That's what keeps the lights on most of the shelters, as well as the Violence Against Women Act funding. That's been also subject to the sequester. And the programs were on the edge to begin with. We do, at the National Network to End Domestic Violence, do an annual census of programs where for a 24-hour period, midnight to midnight, every program in the country reports in on how many victims they serve, what kind of services they provided, how many adults, how many children, and also how many people were not able to get, people who requested services that they weren't able to provide. And in the last census, in that 124-hour period, over 65,000 people were served, but 10,400 reached out for services and were told, no, we can't help you. In a situation where that many people in a single day already aren't getting services, and then you add a sequester, this was pre-sequester, then you add the sequester on top of that, it really is devastating.
The nation is coming back from a major recession with high rates of long-term unemployment, debt, foreclosures. How does the economy affect the level of domestic violence across the country?
Well, we do know that in situations where there is unemployment or layoffs, that tends to increase domestic violence. But it goes beyond that because there are so many economic connections with domestic violence. In our recent census, 59% of victims said that the reason or one of the reasons they returned to the abusive home or didn't leave was for economic reasons. There was not enough money to establish a separate household. There wasn't enough money to be able to get a car or to even save up enough to leave.
The Violence Against Women Act was first passed in 1994, and it's been reauthorized several times since then. It wasn't easy, but it was reauthorized and signed by President Obama in March. In your view, why did the reauthorization of the act and its funding become difficult in 2012?
I have my own theory about that, which I don't know whether it's a valid one or not, but my sense was that there was a disinclination, if you will, to give the president a major signing opportunity on an issue of importance to women right before the elections. And my belief was that once the elections were over, that the bill would in fact pass fairly quickly. It didn't pass as quickly as I thought it would. But I said to a number of people at the time, if I were John Boehner, I wouldn't want the president to have his first term bookended by signing the Lilly Ledbetter Act on his first day and the Violence Against Women Act on his last day when women voters are so important. And if I were John Boehner, I wouldn't want him to have that opportunity. So I think they came up with some reasons to oppose it. And then those reasons actually got entrenched.
You've stated that the act has been strengthened, but is it adequately funded?
It's not adequately funded, in part because I think there simply isn't the will in Congress to allocate the money to do it. The Violence Against Women Act has been authorized at a certain amount. A lot of people think that when you pass a bill, and you pass a bill that says we're going to spend $50 million on X, well, if the Appropriations Committee doesn't appropriate the $50 million, you could spend exactly zero on X. And that's what's happened with the Violence Against Women Act and with some of the other funding. The Violence Against Women Act is authorized by Congress. The amount that Congress attached to the bill is $569 million a year, which is sounds like a lot of money, but spread out over 3,000 domestic violence and sexual assault programs and prosecutors and police programs and judges and all of the various entities, it comes out to not very much money. But the reality is it's only being funded at about $420 million. So it's authorized at a level that could really make a difference, and it's being funded far, far below that level.
You are in Western North Carolina, home to the Eastern Band of Cherokee. This year's reauthorization gives tribal governments criminal jurisdiction over non-Indians who commit crimes on reservations. How significant a change is that to the act?
Huge. Huge. It was that was hard fought. I think that was the last real sticking point. And once there was a concession on that, then the bill passed easily. It's so critical, because what was happening all over the country, not just here, but we heard it in every state where there are Indian populations, that men from outside the reservation would come onto the reservation. They would commit acts of violence, sexual assault. Sometimes they would date women who were living on the reservation and abuse them. And the only option that the women had was to go to the nearest federal court to press charges and to find the nearest U.S. attorney or federal prosecutor. In some states, that could be 2 to 3 hours away from the reservation. So she would not only have to make that trip, and she may not have transportation, she might not have a car, she might not have any way to get to the U.S. attorney to press charges, and then to come back again for preliminary hearings, and then to come back again to testify at the trial. And it became known, basically, that it was just open season on Indian women.
You have been quoted as saying that an average of 3 women are killed in the U.S. every day by a current or former intimate partner. Do you think most Americans are aware of that?
You know, I don't think that most people are aware of it. It's 1 in 3 women every day across the United States, even more around the world. 1 in 4 women. I mean, you go to the mall, walk down the street, look at the women around you. They look just like you, but 1 in 4 of them has experienced domestic violence. It has a tremendous, tremendous impact on our society as a whole.
So what can be done to ensure that victims of domestic violence have access to safe, affordable housing?
Well, that's one of the biggest problems. When we do our annual census, it comes up over and over, you know, those 10,000 in a single day unmet needs. 65% of the unmet requests were for housing, usually for emergency housing. But the transitional housing is extremely important. If you've got transitional housing for people to go to out of emergency shelter, then you free up the emergency beds. And obviously, if you have affordable housing, that if you've got the victims now employed, they've got some means, and you have affordable housing for them to live in, it means they can restart their lives.
But do you have some suggestions how to realize that goal of finding affordable, safe places for people to live?
Well, you know, I think that for in the case of domestic violence, I think this is a public safety issue, and it needs to be treated as the public safety issue it is. And we need to put a lot more funding into it, whether it's for emergency shelter, transitional shelter, affordable housing, counseling, prevention, educating police officers, judges, prosecutors. The shelters, I think, are first responders in the same way that police and fire departments are. They are there for a person who is in an extreme life-threatening emergency, but we're not doing enough to address that.
So what are some of the common myths about domestic violence related to age, economic status, race, religion, level of education, urban or rural?
Well, you know, I think that probably the biggest myth is that it happens to people who aren't like me. Whatever me is, you know, whatever group you identify with, you say, oh, well, that happens to other people. That doesn't happen to my friends or my relatives or my colleagues or the people I went to school with because we're different. And many women, most women, would say that would never happen to me. Someone who's never experienced that kind of power and control situation think, oh, I would never succumb to that. I would walk away. But they find later that it's not so clear and so easy.
But does it cut across all socioeconomic levels and rural, urban? It's a problem all across the United States.
All religions, nationalities, sexual identity, gender identity. It crosses all lines. There is one myth, though, that has been perpetuated by a lot of people who opposed the Violence Against Women Act, and that is that women and men commit intimate partner violence at the same rate. And I guess they think if they say it often enough that people will believe it's true. And they do cite a study which said that there were acts of aggression, I think, when they looked at men and women over time, that men and women had committed an equal number of acts of aggression. But they, you know, throwing a bedroom slipper is the same as beating the hell out of somebody. Each one is an act of aggression. And in that study, if you read to the end of the study, they said, yes, but the women were overwhelmingly the ones who were injured or who were left worse off after the situation.
You raise the issue of critics and criticism of the Violence Against Women Act. Some of the criticism goes like this, that it's an overreach on the part of the federal government. It's the act is a threat to family values, and it doesn't focus on the true causes of violence.
Well, I think that those critics probably don't know much about the Violence Against Women Act, and they're repeating something that they've heard from other people, because the Violence Against Women Act is basically a funding bill. It provides funding for shelters, for research, for technical assistance, which means advice from experts, for trauma-informed care so that you can have best practices in helping people who are in violent and abusive situations. It includes training of police officers and judges to understand the dynamics of intimate partner violence. It's not it's not really a set of laws that require things or prohibit things. It's simply funding what is a serious public health issue in this country.
You have had a long career as an advocate for women. You first volunteered with the National Organization for Women at the age of 19. You had a leadership role with the organization for more than 20 years on many different fronts. Much progress has been made by women in the United States. But can the same be said when it comes to the level of domestic violence in the United States?
Domestic violence does appear to be decreasing. It looked like it was increasing for a while. It may be because more people were willing to come forward. There is still a stigma attached to domestic violence, which is why you don't have as many victims coming forward publicly to say, yes, I was abused, because there's still a sense that it was wrong, that somehow you did something wrong, that you were a victim. But it's not as bad as it was when I was growing up and when I first started working in this area. It was a complete taboo. And in fact, people did say, I was talking to a guy the other day who works at Allstate Insurance Company, he's one of the vice presidents, and he came from an abusive home when he was a child, and he told of going to an emergency room with his mother, and the doctor patched her up yet again and said, try not to make him mad next time.
Why is this your calling?
It really touches me very deeply. It started when I was involved with the local NOW chapter, and some of the women had started this fledgling they called it a battered women's shelter, but it was really just a little house with a few bedrooms and a few volunteers who tried to keep it open. And they needed help with their garage sales because that's how they paid the bills. They had a garage sale every single Sunday, 52 weeks a year. And they recruited me to volunteer at the yard sales and the garage sales. And I gradually just learned more. Victims would come out and volunteer, and they would talk about what a difference it had made for them to have a safe place to go and somebody to talk to. And it just, I really didn't understand anything about domestic violence at that time. It really opened my eyes and opened my heart.
We're running short on time. A couple of political questions as we wrap this up. Assess the Obama administration and its commitment to the issues that are important to you.
The Obama administration, I think, has been very responsive on these issues, particularly Vice President Biden. This is clearly his number one issue. He was the author of the original Violence Against Women Act. I worked with him at the time when he was a senator. This was his baby, and he cares very, very much about it. Was, I think, through his good offices that the White House appointed the first ever White House advisor on violence against women, Len Rosenthal, who is a former executive director of the organization I now head. And she represents the president and the vice president in advocating on these issues with other federal agencies.
You supported Hillary Clinton in her bid for the Democratic nomination to run for president. Do you expect her to run, and are you urging her to run?
I have not talked with her about it, but I hope she will run. I think she would be a fabulous president, and it's hard for me to imagine anyone better prepared to step into the Oval Office.
Kim Gandy is president and CEO of the National Network to End Domestic Violence. She is in Western North Carolina at the invitation of Pisgah Legal Services. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.